the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Professor Emerita of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Alaska Anchorage, Dr. Diddy Hitchens, speaks on Marshall Goldman's perspective on Russia's energy politics. Professor Diddy Hitchens has used Marshall Goldman's books in her classroom for many years. An internationally recognized authority on Russian economics, politics, and environmental policy, when he could not make it to Alaska this past week due to the eruption of Mount Redoubt, Professor Hitchens gladly stepped in. Diddy Hitchens is currently Professor Emerita of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Alaska Anchorage and past president of the Association for Canadian Studies in the U.S. Born in Scotland, she grew up in southern England, going to school in Winchester. Her initial academic appointment was at the University of Ghana at Legion in West Africa. She joined the faculty of UAA in 1975, attaining the rank of tenured professor in 1982. A specialist in comparative politics and international relations, she was the founding director of both the Canadian Studies and the International North Pacific Studies programs at UAA. Since 1985, Diddy Hitchens has been the British Honorary Consul for Alaska. Queen Elizabeth II recognized her for this service in 2005 with the award of an MBE, meaning Member of the Order of the British Empire. Despite retiring from regular teaching duties, Diddy Hitchens is still fully engaged in research and development activities, focusing on the Arctic Circumpolar region with a special focus on Canada and the Russian Far East. On Friday, March 27th, Professor Diddy Hitchens spoke on Marshall Goldman's perspective on Russia's energy politics. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Professor Emerita of Political Science and International Studies at UAA, Dr. Diddy Hitchens.
I want to begin by apologizing to you all for being here and addressing you. None of you, not one of you, I can assure you, is more disappointed than I am that Marshall Goldman is not here today. I think most of you know I'm a professor of comparative politics, and I have taught the politics of the North Pacific region, China, the Koreas, Japan, Russia, and Canada for almost 30 years at UAA. I'm actually now emeritus. I don't have to do it. I still choose to. But when I came to Alaska in 1974, I was a specialist on Europe and Africa, and the only one of the North Pacific nation states that I had had undergraduate and graduate preparation on was Russia, although then, of course, it was the Soviet Union or the USSR. I had been in England, in Germany, and in Scandinavia in seminars with top-notch academics, British and European, who had expertise on the Soviet Union. I quickly discovered when I started to prepare to teach the Soviet Union as a case study here at UAA and needed to find textbook materials available here in the USSA, that even the academic approach to the USSR in the USA was completely in the straitjacket of hostile Cold War ideological framework thinking and was virulently anti-Soviet and anti-communist. So the texts available were, in my opinion, polemics, not empirically based social science analysis, and I was not willing to use them. The classic or standard U.S. text at the time was Harvard scholar Merle Feinsod's How Russia is Ruled. This is in 1974. It had been through any number of editions and was called How Russia is Ruled, which is an indication of what it was like. It was completely unacceptable to me, even the title. But when in 1980, Jerry Huff from Duke University was commissioned to update it, it was transformed into a systematic comparative analysis of the political system under the title How the Soviet Union is Governed. Jerry Huff identified the weaknesses of the political system of the so-called superpower and predicted as early as 1982 that the Soviet Union would fail if it did not make major adaptations in its political system. He was the first to predict the failure of the Soviet system, and at that time, I was happy to invite him to speak at the Alaska World Affairs Council, and some of you may remember that he came on two separate occasions, separated by about 5 years, and spoke to the World Affairs Council when nobody was talking about the potential failure of the Soviet Union. His prediction was right on, of course. His analysis was rejected by the traditional Harvard hardliners and by the CIA, whose analysis completely failed to identify the weaknesses. The only other specialist on the USSR identifying its weaknesses in the mid-1980s was the economist Marshall Goldman. Harvard University Press did not continue publishing Jerry Huff's contract to bring out updated editions of the classic text. And so by the 1990s, when I was teaching Russia as a case study, and increasingly I was also teaching courses on the Russian Far East specifically, I was using European texts but supplementing them with Marshall Goldman's books. After the fall of the USSR, two of Marshall Goldman's books in particular were the best analysis that one could get on Russia. In 2003, he brought out Piratization of Russia, Russian Reform Goes Awry, which I actually managed to obtain, having talked to him directly, as a proof copy before it was published. So my students actually had the manuscript form before it was actually published. And he was very gracious in that he was delighted that there was a class in Alaska that wanted to use it. We weren't a very big class. I don't know what the publisher thought, but we had 12 proof copies of it before it came out. And then in 2005, he published The Oligarchs. Though both of these books were written from an economic perspective, the intertwining of the economic and the political in Russia, as a result of the foregoing Soviet communist system in which all means of production were in the hands of the state, meant that in explaining and analyzing the economic system, Marshall Goldman also revealed and played a powerful searchlight on the political system. As you all know, Marshall Goldman was due to be here today to talk about the analysis of Russia in his new book published in 2008, Petrostate, Putin, Power, and the New Russia. Of particular interest to us, or we Alaskans, who also live in a petrostate. And to bring his incisive analysis of Russia to bear on the contemporary situation of global economic downturn, which occurred after the book went to press. I was delighted when I learned that Marshall Goldman was coming. I immediately bought the book so that I could read it before hearing his presentation. But of course, I had other things to do, and I didn't actually get around to it. But I did invite the four people that I know in Anchorage who I regularly discuss Russian politics with and who are most knowledgeable about Russia. They didn't include Vic Fisher, who I knew would be here because he's a member of the World Affairs Council and would certainly be here. But Russ Howell, Gunnar Knapp, John Tichotsky, and Alexandra Maloney I had invited to come to hear him, indicating my high regard for his analysis. Yesterday afternoon, Lisa Falsco called me with the bad news that Professor Goldman might not make it through Mount Redoubt's ash, and she asked if I could step in. And I said to her, oh, sure, I'll do an update on the politics of China, of Japan, or of the Koreas, all of which I had just updated for guest lectures in Professor Dunscombe's East Asia classes. I did them last week. But I hadn't updated Russia because he doesn't include Russia as a case in his East Asia classes. But it was evident in the silence on the other end of the phone that Lisa was disappointed, because what the crowd wanted was Russia. So with not a little trepidation, I said to her, okay, what I'll do is present a summary of Professor Goldman's thesis in his book. Now, I actually had commitments at UAA last night, two separate commitments from 4:30 to 6:30 and then from 7 till 10. But I went straight home at 10 and started reading Petrostate, which I finished at 2 a.m. And then I started writing my presentation. And what this is my attempt to present to you the essence of Marshall Goldman's argument in the book, which is a very good book, which I knew it would be, because it's written by him. And I actually finished at 5:30 this morning. Normally, when I do a presentation nowadays, I don't do it on yellow sheets. I do it on a computer. But it's actually quicker to do it the old way. And Marshall Goldman says that that's how he does his books. And he says it's amazing that the students who then take it and get it published can read his writing. Well, normally when I used to use yellow pages for doing presentations, I would go through at least three or four versions. And by the one I was going to use when I was standing up here, it was usually beautifully written and clear. Today it's got squiggles all over it. You'll have to forgive me. This was the first draft. I did manage to go over a little bit second, but this is the best I can do for you at that short notice. And I am happy to be here, though I am sad that it's not Marshall Goldman. To put it in a nutshell, in Petrostate, Marshall Goldman chronicles in detail the period since the end of his last book. In other words, from 1998 to 2007, less than a decade, when Russia went from financial crisis and defaulting on its debt, which many in the USA took to be the final death knell for its superpower status, to reemergence as a new energy superpower. Although Marshall Goldman points out that Vladimir Putin refuses to accept that terminology. He will not let you say that Russia is a new energy superpower. Marshall Goldman focuses, or the period that Marshall Goldman focuses on, coincides with the period of Vladimir Putin's ascension to power in Russia. First, as Boris Yeltsin's fourth prime minister in 12 months, Putin became prime minister in August of 1999, and then on January the 1st, 2000, 4 months later, emerged as Yeltsin's chosen successor to be president of Russia. In Petrostate, Marshall Goldman focuses on Russia specifically as an energy superpower. So he provides the background history from 1723, when Peter the Great extended Russia's rule to the Caspian Sea, incorporating the oil-rich area of Baku and the Caucasus into Russia, and then 1821, when Russia began to develop and exploit the petroleum. Goldman points out that several times in history, from 1898 until 1901, from 1975 until 1992, and from 2007 until the present day, Russia has led the world in petroleum production. But it is natural gas which Marshall Goldman claims is Russia's new secret weapon. In a section that he heads, Power Out of a Pipeline, he says, and I will quote directly, "While its petroleum exports have generated the cash blizzard that has made Russia rich and allowed it to repay most of its foreign state debt, It's natural gas and monopoly control of the gas pipelines that transport the gas to the West have transformed Russia from an anemic and essentially bankrupt charity case into a robust energy superpower with restored political muscle. In his introductory chapter, Goldman makes the case that Russia's newfound power as an energy superpower has made Europe vulnerable. And again, I quote, "With its natural gas and oil pipelines that tie Europe to Russia like an umbilical cord, Russia has unchecked powers and influence that in a real sense exceed the military power and influence it had in the Cold War. No matter how many nuclear weapons it may have had, the USSR was prevented from using them by the knowledge that the United States had a comparable number and would counter the USSR's use of them and vice versa. This was referred to as mutually assured destruction, or MAD, which meant no one country would dare attack the other. Now, however, if Russia decides to reduce or suspend the flow of gas through its pipeline to Ukraine and or to Europe, there is virtually nothing to restrain it from doing so. There is no comparable mutual assured restraint, or MAR. It is also noteworthy that this gives Russia more economic clout with Europe than Saudi Arabia, because the Saudis export relatively little natural gas. There are no consuming countries dependent on a Saudi pipeline for this commodity. This is an important strategic difference." But he argues that it's not only Europe that finds itself each day becoming more and more dependent on energy exports from Russia. The United States is also importing and consuming more Russian energy as it tries, like Europe, to diversify and reduce its over-reliance on the Middle East. In 2006, the U.S. imported 3% of its petroleum from Russia, a small amount. Lukoil, one of Russia's major private oil companies, provides it and purchased nearly 3,000 gas filling stations in the U.S. from Getty and Mobil Oil in the last couple of years. Even though there are no natural gas pipelines connecting the United States with Russia, Gazprom, which is Russia's largest company and was in 2006 the third largest company in the world after ExxonMobil and General Electric, the world's largest producer of natural gas, a state-dominated joint stock corporation, has begun supplying the United States with liquid natural gas through a swap arrangement. And Gazprom in 2007 anticipated that by 2010 it would be providing 10% of U.S. natural gas as LNG. Now, Marshall makes it clear that he thinks that's an unrealistic prediction. Although Marshall Goldman thinks that it is unlikely that the U.S. will ever become as beholden to Russia for its energy as Germany or Austria have become, nevertheless, Russia's emergence as an energy superpower will have a long-term impact on the U.S. and world diplomacy, if for no other reason than that our European allies will begin to think twice before saying no to Russia. That Russia has gained this power, he argues, is only partly by chance. Given that Russia is by far the largest geographic political entity in the world, it's not surprising that it should contain vast petroleum and gas resources. And the size of a country's resources does make a difference in the way a country develops. But an abundance of energy resources can be a curse as well as a blessing, and may well have a negative effect on development of the country's manufacturing sector, may result in a struggle for access and control of those resources, and relying on energy as the main export can corrupt a country in more ways than the most obvious, which is very, very obvious in the Russian case, in the period that Marshall Goldman is focusing on. Before I go further, let me tell you that the content of this book is remarkable, not only because Marshall Goldman is a long-established senior scholar and expert on Russia with good support and extraordinary range of contacts in Russia, but also because for this book, he had unprecedented access to decision makers in both the United States and Russia for his research. It was Marshall Goldman who was called by the White House to brief President George W. Bush on the new strategic U.S.-Russia relationship prior to the 2006 meeting in Petersburg, in St. Petersburg, which was chaired by President Putin, who insisted that energy, security, and Russia's role as a reliable superpower should be the general theme of the G8 meeting. Marshall Goldman had several additional briefing meetings with Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. But in addition, the Novosti Press Agency included Professor Goldman in the prestigious Valdai Hills discussion group, which met with President Putin at his home, which is the Valdai Hills, on four occasions. And Marshall Goldman reports in the book that he was able to ask very searching questions and that he received very frank answers from President Putin. In addition, Novosti took the group out to the Pribyotskaya oil fields and Yugansk Naftgaz and arranged meetings at Gazprom headquarters. This is extraordinary access. Marshall Goldman says himself in his preface, "It was as if I had died and gone to heaven." He starts the book in a section which he entitles "The Author as James Bond," with the visit to Gazprom's headquarters. And he says he was puzzled, for such a sleek, big, glass, high-rise building in Moscow, the elevator was tiny. It only held five people. And those five, his group, were ushered down a narrow corridor into a darkened, silent room where nothing seemed to be happening. Only when the whole group, five at a time, emerging from the elevator, had arrived in the room, it was revealed to be the dispatching center, with a 100-foot wall map with a spiderweb-like maze of natural gas pipelines reaching from eastern Siberia, or as we would say, the Russian Far East, west to the Atlantic Ocean, and from the Arctic Ocean to the Caspian and Black Seas. Manipulating this display were three Gazprom dispatchers. From that room, controlling the flow of Gazprom's gas to East and Western European consumers of this Russian natural gas monopoly. No wonder there was such tight security. He says, "For a time, I felt as if I had wandered into the NASA Space Center. Or was it a James Bond movie set? All that was missing was that an out-of-body voice should have been intoning, 'Welcome, Mr. Goldman. We were expecting you.'" Clearly, it was this experience at Gazprom's headquarters that brought home to Professor Goldman the power of Gazprom, that with the flick of a switch, those dispatchers could supply or freeze the supply of entire countries, as Russia has now done on two occasions only the first of which is covered in the book. The second happened in 2008 after it went to press, in the case of the Ukraine, with knock-on effects on the supply of gas to other European countries. The Russian mantra is that Russia is a reliable energy partner. And on that visit to Gazprom, it was Alexander Medvedev, then deputy chair of Gazprom, now Mr. Putin's successor as president, who assured the visitors that this was so, that Russia is a reliable energy partner. Although the weapon has not been used against a West European country, it has been used on former Soviet republics such as the Ukraine, and East European states such as Hungary have had the potential power clearly pointed out and underlined to them. And as Professor Goldman clearly illustrates, the current situation has been carefully crafted like a game of chess by Vladimir Putin with his control of Gazprom, the state-owned company, and the state-owned petroleum company, Rosneft. He has the tools to create wealth and influence for the benefit of the interests of the Russian state. The introductory chapter of Petrostate sets out the thesis. The second chapter provides the background history. The third chapter, entitled Pirates Unleashed, Privatization in the Post-Soviet Era, is a condensation of his 2003 book on how reform went awry. Chapter 4 deals with the post-1998 recovery and the Russian petroleum export bonanza. It was prior to this period, when Russia was experiencing financial difficulties, that there was also a drop in oil prices. And the new owners of privatized oil companies in Russia, who had bought them very cheaply and got them through the voucher share system, which the Russian public on the whole didn't understand and thought that their shares weren't worth the value of a bottle of vodka. The new owners of privatized oil companies, when the oil prices dropped in the 1990s, halted exploration and cut back production. Essentially, they just stripped out the assets of the companies. Russian crude oil output dropped 40% between 1990 and 1998. But when the world economy quickly began to recover, oil prices rose again, especially in response to new demand from China and India. The new owners, the oligarchs, and the managers of Russian oil saw the opportunity to make money through exploration and production. But they needed better technology and expertise. So they turned to Western oil companies and Western oil field service companies to enter into production sharing agreements. Such companies as Phillips, ConocoPhillips, Exxon, Texaco, Amoco, and BP all became involved in Russia, and Halliburton and Schlumberger were engaged in major oil field development. They all became involved in Russia, working with the oligarchs and dealing with, in particular, it was the foreign technology that they brought to bear on difficult oil exploration areas such as Sakhalin and the far north areas. But as soon as the production started to flow, thanks to the new technology, President Putin stepped in to denounce the production sharing agreements as colonial treaties and moved to either renationalize companies or at least to ensure that the controlling interest of at least 51% of the shares lay with the Russian partner. In this way, most of the oligarchs who had shady backgrounds, most of them either got into their oil positions through being traders or through the mafia, were dispossessed of their oil companies and either went into exile, as was the case with Boris Berezovsky, who originally owned Sibneft, and then subsequently Roman Abramovich, who had taken on Sibneft, or they went into jail, as did Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was the previous owner of Yukos. And the oil companies came back under the control of what are now called the Siloviki. Siloviki means law and order, strongmen. That is to say, former KGB or military or police strongmen who, along with the St. Petersburg Mafia, the group of technocrats and ex-KGB people who Putin brought with him from his previous post in Petersburg, now became the people who were running what Putin likes now to call the national champions, the major business enterprises, whose purpose it is to serve the interests of the Russian state. The Siloviki now command the heights of the economy in the interests of the state, which means, according to President Putin's design and the game of chess that he is playing. These Siloviki hold appointments in the oil and gas companies and other lucrative business sectors simultaneously with holding government posts, and they are protected by their patron, Mr. Putin. These are now called the second generation oligarchs, and unlike the first generation, who were bandits and outsiders, often shady characters, more associated with Mr. Yeltsin than with Mr. Putin, this new generation are very definitely insiders. They are Mr. Putin's people. They're actually referred to by Marshall Goldman by the acronym FOP, Friends of Putin. In the last chapter, Russia, the unrestrained super energy power, Marshall Goldman talks of the new economic imperialism and reiterates his concern that all of Europe is now dependent on a monopoly natural gas supplier that has no built-in restraint. He does stress that he's not arguing that Russia can do whatever it wants with its natural gas reserves. Writing in 2007, he made one percipient comment, although I don't think he carried it far enough. He says, "What could happen, for example, if there were a world recession and or demand for Russia's gas and oil should suddenly slacken? After all, it is not as if Russia had no petroleum or gas reserves prior to 2000. Russia has been the world's leading producer of natural gas for some time, as well as a major, if not the largest, petroleum producer for many years. So why is it only now that Russia and Gazprom have become such concerns to the Europeans?" The answer, in large part, is that as China and India have come of age, financially, they have gobbled up most of the slack in the energy market. Despite the increasing emphasis on energy conservation, overall world demand continues to grow. At the same time, some of the existing reserves in Western Europe are being depleted. A far-reaching recession would undoubtedly precipitate a drop in commodity prices, just as it did in 1997. And 1998, but at best that would be a short and temporary problem. Marshall Goldman is more concerned with the adequacy of Russia's supply than with a downturn in demand. He really didn't foresee the current global economic downturn, and we certainly shouldn't criticize him for that. After all, who did? At his meetings with Putin, Marshall Goldman asked questions, hard questions about the oil industry and its ownership, questions about Putin's likely succession to the, or who would be the successor, and so on. But he also asked Putin about Russia's social problems, particularly about population decline and poverty. But he returns at the end of the book. Before Medvedev and Putin had swapped roles, to the newly assertive Russia, illustrated by its claim to the North Pole in 2007, and also challenging the authority of the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization, and the way that the United States, Europe, and Japan seem to run these organizations as if they were a private club. Since the onset of the economic downturn in late 2008, Putin has in several speeches questioned Western capitalism and democracy and has been quite condescending about its success. This obviously was a chance to restore the balance for him after the humiliation Russia received from the fall of the Soviet Union through 1998. The gist of Marshall Goldman's argument is that a newly let me just say one more thing. As I was driving here today, I heard on the radio an announcement that Mr. Putin has now designated the Arctic and Russian resources in the Arctic as the Russian government's most significant strategic interest and challenge, and has said that in order to beef up its claim to the North Pole and the resources in the Arctic, it will increase its military, specifically, generally, and in that area, in order to support this Arctic interest. So I'm able to update Marshall Goldman a little bit. The gist of Marshall Goldman's argument is that a newly self-confident Russia, wealthy as a result of last year's extremely high oil prices, I would add, has now regained superpower status on the basis of its energy resources and markets, and is demanding the respect it feels it deserves at a time when the United States and Western Europe are brought low by the global financial crisis that began in the unregulated finance sector of the United States. Thank you.
You've been listening to Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Dr. Diddy Hitchens, Professor Emerita of Political Science and International Studies at UAA. Recorded on Friday, March 27th, she spoke on Marshall Goldman's perspective on Russia's energy politics after Marshall Goldman's airplane was grounded due to the eruption of Mount Redoubt. Following her talk and summary of Mr. Goldman's book, she responded to questions from the audience. In her talk, Dr. Hitchens mentioned that Alaska is a petrostate like Russia. An audience member asked her, in reviewing Marshall Goldman's book, did you give any thought to that statement?
The only thought I gave to it was that between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. when I was reading the book, every single line of it was obvious to me how interesting it would be to Alaskans, and that every Alaskan ought to buy the book and read the book. I must admit, I didn't have time to go beyond that, but since I work on the Russian Far East, and I also, you know, I never forget that there are still those in Russia who claim that Alaska still should belong to them. It will be something for me for my next presentation, John.
In 2007, when Western Europe's gas supply was shut off, Russia claimed that Ukraine had stolen the gas. An audience member asked, if Alaska were to build a gas line to the lower 48, and at some point Canada should steal our gas, how should we react?
Let me first respond to the first part of what you said. There have been two occasions when Russia has cut back on the supply to Ukraine, and it's done so on the basis of exactly the same argument each time. What they've done is that initially Ukraine was receiving gas from Russia, not at the price which the West Europeans pay, which is $150,000 per, I don't know how much it is, but anyway, I only need to say this for comparative purposes. The Ukraine were getting it at $50,000. So when the Ukraine in 2007 turned out to be less than amenable to the interests of Russia and seemed to be being too friendly with the West Europeans, but more importantly seemed to be being way too friendly with the United States, and when you may recall there were issues over the election in Ukraine, and certainly Putin interfered. When the Ukraine appeared not to be being acting in the interests of Russia, but rather playing with the United States' interests, Mr. Putin said they needed to pay $150,000. Therefore, they recalculated how much Ukraine had bought in the contract. So they got only one-third of what they thought they had paid for. Because they only got one-third sent to them, they just took what they needed, which was the whole three-thirds, the whole amount, out of the pipeline. But that pipeline's the same pipeline that delivers to Eastern and to Western Europe. And so when I said the knock-on effect, it meant that since they disputed what they were having to pay and they felt that they had bought three times as much as Russia said they had bought, it was a neat little ploy that Putin knew that Ukraine would continue to take the same amount, and that would mean that the full supply didn't go to Eastern or to Western Europe. And that was again what happened in 2008. And Mr. Putin could just say, oh, but it's not our fault, it's Ukraine. Ukraine is taking your supply. And he could therefore do what Marshall Goldman insists on so much, which is not be an unreliable supplier in theoretical terms to Western Europe, but simply be an unreliable supplier to the Ukraine that is then demonstrated to be an unreliable ally to the West Europeans. On your second point, I'm very careful about what I say about American politics, because as you know from my voice, I'm an alien. And I'm also representative of the British government, and so I walk a particularly difficult line because I'm concerned about the interests of BP and the British government, as well as not treading on the toes of the United States. The one thing I really feel is an Alaskan. I do feel I'm an Alaskan. And I will say, as an Alaskan and an unrepentant environmentalist, and also someone who teaches Canada and perhaps knows Canada better than any of the cases that I teach on the North Pacific, I've devoted much, much time to Canada and to Alberta. I suspect that if we send our gas south through Canada, it will all go to processing what I will continue to call the tar sands, despite the fact that Prime Minister Harper would like us to call them oil sands nowadays. But it will all go to the tar sands, which will mean that Canada will get the benefit from it. I mean, we'll get paid for it, that's no problem. But environmentally, that processing is going to be utterly devastating of the environment, specifically of the use of water, because it takes an enormous amount of water. I've been up to see the development in Alberta, and it's shocking and frightful, and I would like to see it stop tomorrow.
In Marshall Goldman's chess game, does he at all mention Putin's support of Iran's nuclear development program?
In this book, he doesn't mention it at all. If you look in the index, Iran is not even in it.
Next, another audience member asked, in his book, did Goldman discuss the closing of the Mediterranean power loop?
He has one chapter where he talks in tremendous detail about all of the different partnerships and all of the new developments. And I have to be honest, as a political scientist and reading this when, you know, I was not at my best, to put it mildly, there were some details that I skipped over. One thing I didn't skip over was, BP, I think, in particular, but the Western Europeans are really trying hard to come up with an alternative line, or at least they were trying hard to come up with an alternative line that would go down through the Black Sea, I think, and would mean that Western Europe would not need to be so dependent on it coming through Ukraine and coming through from Russia. And Marshall talks at length about how Putin worked very hard to pressure Hungary, which is getting tremendous income as the sort of distribution center. If you look at the maps of the pipelines going over Western Europe, Hungary is really benefiting greatly from the fact that that pipeline goes through Ukraine and through Hungary, whereas with the Western line, it would be Austria that would be the distribution point. And especially now with the downturn in the economy, but even in 2007, Marshall Goldman argues quite convincingly that actually without the East Europeans and Hungary supporting that alternative route, it just plain isn't economically feasible. And so that other line, you know, may never come to be.
Last, a member of the audience asked Dr. Hitchens if she had any particular insight on Russia's preparedness to deal with their own and international environmental concerns that coincide with future oil and gas development and climate change.
Well, as I think we all know, during the period at the end of the Soviet Union, it gradually became revealed just how disastrous their development had been and how in the Soviet period there had been very little environmental concern. In the 90s, under the oligarchs, Marshall Goldman points out how the people who became the owners of the oil companies had no experience whatsoever with oil production. In fact, he points out that Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who took over Yukos, which was the biggest producing company, and Khodorkovsky became the richest man in Russia. Khodorkovsky had actually never been on an oil site and had never seen oil produced and didn't even know what he was looking at when he was first there. During that period of the 1990s, the people who owned the oil were only interested in stripping out the assets, pumping as much as they could in terms of getting money, but with the low prices, they certainly weren't going to put anything into environmental. Obviously, when the Western oil companies went in the partnership schemes in the latter part of the 90s, then they brought with them technology, but they also brought with them a commitment that they weren't going to operate at any less environmental level in Russia than they would elsewhere, except we know, don't we? I mean, We may love the oil companies, but we know that it's only the specific regulation that's there and on the books that they will live up to. There's no point in us hoping that they're going to be, you know, kind and good and so on. And that's reasonable enough. Their role is to make profit. So you have to make sure that you have the environmental framework in which they will live up to our expectations and operate at the highest environmental level possible. Clearly, that wasn't the case. So even those companies that had the environmental know-how, unless they were John Brown, who was BP, who was utterly committed to beyond petroleum and would become an environmental company, you will all remember, he ceased to lobby for the opening of ANWR, which upset people here. He became an environmentalist. I suspect that there were plenty of operations that got by at a very low level. I don't think that Mr. Putin or his colleagues now think that the environment is the most important thing. They will participate up to the level that ensures that they have a seat at the table, that they're not vilified, and that they can, from time to time, be condescending towards the United States because, after all, it's the biggest producer of pollution as far as they're concerned. But certainly, production of oil in Russia and the transport of natural gas and the whole development there is still at a shockingly low level of environmental concern, in my opinion.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Dr. Diddy Hitchens, Professor Emerita of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Recorded on Friday, March 27th, she responded to questions from the audience following her talk on Marshall Goldman's perspective on Russia's energy politics. As Marshall Goldman was unable to reach Alaska due to the eruption of Mount Redoubt last Thursday, he said he hopes to visit Alaska and speak at the Alaska World Affairs Council in the near future. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.